Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. It's never an easy call with so many problems in the world to know where to direct the money that you donate when you want to help out in this world. But what I can tell you is that when you donate to CAMH, you're saving lives. We know about the opioid crisis. We know about the mental health crisis. They are doing the work. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at CAMH.ca/CanadaLand to help us treat addiction and build hope. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
A couple of years ago, a group called Journalists for Human Rights was curious about how the media portrays Aboriginal people. They analyzed over 700,000 Canadian news stories. What they found was that only 0.46% of them had anything to do with Aboriginal people, cultures, and issues. This in a country where Aboriginal people make up almost 4.5% of the population. Underrepresentation was certainly an issue, but beyond that, the type of representation also turned out to be a problem. 39% of the stories that actually were about Aboriginal people were found to portray them and their issues in a negative light. Well, since 1999, APTN, Aboriginal People's Television Network, has been doing its part to push back against those numbers. It is television by and for Indigenous people, and it is considered the first Indigenous TV network in the world, and it will soon be expanding into the United States. I recently had a chance to sit down with Karen Pugliese, APTN's Director of News and Current Affairs at their Winnipeg headquarters on Portage Avenue, where their staff had recently been blocked access by police who had seized their news crew's camera. I'm going to talk about that and a lot more with Karen in a minute. Wait for it. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Jeff Sisler, Peregrinus, Karen Webster, Mark Rigier, Mike Paduada, Elise Bigley, Monique M., Barry Cohen, Stephen Robertson, Shane Smith, and Raymond Bissinger. Raymond, why did you decide to be awesome?
I support Canada Land because it's the most cost-effective way to annoy some of my Toronto media friends.
This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We hear a lot about the opioid crisis. We talk a lot about the mental health crisis. These are serious problems. These problems affect us all. They've affected my life and my community. They are not intractable problems. I don't know what's going to solve them on a policy level, but day to day, helping people, that's what CAMH does. They do it on the ground when people need help, and they do it through research. The team at CAMH gave our team a tour of their facilities, and we were really just blown away by the incredible, heroic work that they're doing every day. They treat everyone with dignity, and their research is seeking and finding real solutions for everyone around the world. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at CAMH.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer, and it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit Douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer.
This episode is also brought to you by FreshBooks Cloud Accounting, the easy-to-use invoicing solution designed for small business owners like Rachel Young, who runs Camaraderie Co-working. I asked Rachel what she likes best about FreshBooks.
I'm on the go all the time, and so their Android app is the best thing that they could have made for me. I can literally do everything from the mobile app. I can literally be sitting on a streetcar and sending invoices to our members, or editing an invoice, or doing whatever it is that I need to do from that mobile app. And that was a huge gift when they released that.
FreshBooks Cloud Accounting is the first sponsor of Canada Land. It is the accounting software I use, and you can try it out for free for 30 days when you go to freshbooks.com/CanadaLand. Make sure to tell them who sent you.
Did the cops ever apologize?
Not directly to me. I've got to say, I was out in Ottawa at the time, so I'm kind of handling all of this remotely. It was my show producer that was on the scene. What they said to her in the end when they were returning the tape was that they were concerned that we would air gore. And she said, well, we would never do that. And it sort of ended there for us.
Maybe you could start at the beginning. I mean, why is it the cops' concern for the editorial decision as to whether or not you air gore? How did this all happen?
I received a call from the show producer saying that there'd been a body found behind APTN. For some reason, there was a rumor or something that was a female. So the first thing that goes is my heart stops. Half of our employees are female. And I'm like, oh my God, is it somebody who works here? Is it somebody we know? And so the story kind of came out in pieces that the security guard had found the body. The cameraman arrived on the scene before the show producer. So he went out and he took shots of the scene. The police had already arrived, but he stayed behind the lines. He did everything that he should do. I think even CTV might have come over at that point and taken tape and left. So I'm not sure why at that point they interfered with our cameraman. The show producer arrived on the scene, had discussions with them. We had our lawyer call. Then they handed the tape back. I think probably the one thing that I was concerned about was just that sort of the way it took off on Twitter, people were confused about here was a person like obviously was murdered. And they were thinking that we had some evidence that the police didn't have and that we were withholding that from them, right?
Right.
And first of all, that wasn't the case at all. What they needed was the security tape. It was not news footage, and that we were always willing to give them.
Yeah.
It was only the ENG camera that we were concerned about.
And these issues of whether they're seizing it so you don't air it or whether they're seizing it because they need it, and then you tweeted something about them not letting you into the building, not letting your people...
They were blocking the elevator at one point, and I'm not sure because, again, I wasn't on the scene. So I'm not sure exactly why that was.
I was wondering, you also mentioned that this wasn't the first time you had problems with the police and trying to cover news.
Yeah, it wasn't the Winnipeg police. We had a seizure years ago. Our Vancouver reporter had been covering a protest, and he had taken some footage. He was leaving. He was getting in his car. He heard a kerfuffle. He ran back, took some footage after the kerfuffle. This was at, I want to say, Sun Peaks. So anyways, he went back and had the results of it. He got into his car, and the police thought that he might have had the actual fight on the tape. Now, whether he did or not, he doesn't have to hand that tape over. But they took everything without a warrant, and we got into a fight over that.
I wonder, when APTN's name comes up, if it's something specific to the fact that it's Aboriginal people covering the news, or if it's something specific to that Aboriginal issues are being looked into, whereas otherwise they might not be. Not to suggest that these kinds of, you know, blocks that you hit happen every week or anything like that, but you are doing something that other people aren't really doing.
We kind of forget what it was like for our people before there was an APTN. But I remember, because I remember it starting up. And in 2000, they started in the newsroom, and I got to be part of it. Mm-hmm. And it was spectacular. I mean, just the idea that we would have our own people going into our communities and telling our own stories. That was, like, it just never been done before. You know, we had people coming by the office, and they felt like an ownership. Like, this is our station, and, you know, come out and tell our story. This is happening in our community. And it was just like a great feeling of pride. And people in the community would say, finally, somebody's listening. In terms of what kind of journalism is it that we're going to do? I mean, we're not there to be advocates for anybody. We're there to tell stories. There's kind of a great feeling that what our contribution is to contribute to the understanding of these issues. You might get a quick little blurb on some of the other mainstream media from time to time. I think Idle No More, which was a whole movement, was just a blip, right? And you still hear mainstream media getting that wrong.
Yeah.
They say it started as a movement against chiefs. It didn't. It started as a movement against omnibus legislation that was damaging the environment. That was what started it.
Why do you think that one narrative of Idle No More being a critique within Aboriginal communities towards, you know, corrupt leadership was a more attractive narrative in mainstream news than the truth?
Was it more attractive, or is it just that they don't understand it? Idle No More had existed for months before the mainstream media picked it up. So they kind of arrived late in the scene, and I think we're trying to make sense of something that had already progressed. You know, we had the same thing with the fracking out in Rexton. You'll remember that story. The mainstream media didn't get there until it sort of became a flashpoint where it sort of got a bit violent. That to them is like, well, there's the news. But for us, the news was people are concerned about the environment. And we'd been following that for a very, very long time. So what you might have seen if you were just following the mainstream media is Native people and police pushing each other. And that doesn't really make any sense. But if you had followed our coverage, you'd know that it was a longstanding issue. It had been a peaceful protest for months up until that point. And you'll get a very different point of view on what it was about.
Is APTN controversial within Aboriginal communities? And do you find resistance and blocked access and pushback from within communities as much as externally?
It depends. It depends on the story. I mean, we have not shied away from taking on stories if somebody is misspending money, if there's funds being misspent, if there's corruption going on. We've never shied away from that. But you find that actually a lot of the grassroots people really kind of are happy to have that exposed. And they trust us that it's not just like that we're not making it up. There's sometimes, I think, in mainstream, just a point of view that anytime anything goes wrong in the community, it must be due to corruption.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily. It's due to insufficient funding. It's due to the fact that you had to rob Peter to pay Paul and you're moving your funds around to try to survive. The fact that there's, you know, like not a school in every community is not because the chiefs are all misspending money. It's because they don't have money to build a school. So sometimes the mainstream media just kind of thinks everything's wrong because everything's corrupt, and that's not true. But when we do find things, we're sure about them. Sometimes there's a negative stereotype out there that I feel that gets assumed. We don't assume that, but we don't shy away on reporting on it when it happens.
You've kind of put your finger on a vulnerability or, you know, something that's broken with news coverage in a wider context too, is that it's only when a fistfight breaks out that's what becomes news. And then there are themes that are attractive. So the theme of corruption, and then that will flash up when there's a specific instance of something going wrong or money being displaced, and then you go back to an assumption that that's something that happens from time to time, and it makes for a compelling news story with personalities. A reality of endemic poverty or communities that are completely underserved or communities where suicide rates are incredibly high, problems that don't have, you know, a face or a fistfight to kind of, you know, identify them, I don't know that the news does a very good job, because in a sense, it's not news when something like that has just been happening for decades and is continuing
to
happen.
Although it is for us.
Right. Yeah. So how do you make that into a narrative that, you know, do you find a news hook for something like that? I mean, how do you approach a story like that?
So we have like these different ways of looking. So we've got the daily news, which is, you know, sort of the stuff that's happening right now that you want to know about. Within that, we have a series that we run that call Perspectives, and they're just sort of more thoughtful pieces. We did one recently on poverty and trying to break out of poverty and the working poor, because we felt like there's a stereotype that people who are poor just are poor because they're sitting on the couch not doing much, when actually a lot of them are out working, struggling, trying to find daycare, trying to find a job that will cover all of this. They're working very hard to try to break out of the cycle of poverty. We did another one on called Bad Medicine, which was a series looking at alcoholism in the communities. Is there a hook on that? Well, not so much that there's a hook that we're looking at. There wasn't a report that came out. The reason to look at it now is just because we need to talk about it sometime.
Yeah. And what is the take up in the community or the communities? Because you are mandatory carriage, yes?
Yes.
I have to imagine that that's the brunt of your financing, is that anybody with as mandatory carriage goes, anybody who subscribes to cable and satellite must pay for certain mandatory carriage stations. So that's millions of people who APTN is through their package, and that's what comes in here.
And then the rest of it's advertising, because we don't take – there's another misconception out there that APTN must be government funded because it's Aboriginal. Guess what? We're not.
Yeah.
We do not take government funding, and you know, so we're independent in that way, and we like it that way.
Yeah, so I'm curious how many people outside of Aboriginal communities watch it, and I'm curious what percentage of people within them watch it.
I wish I could give you an accurate number, but there's a few things, and you would have heard sort of us lamenting this over the years. We look at the BBM and we get fairly good ratings, but they only measure cities, and they only measure, I hope I've got this right, it's Montreal, Toronto, Edmonton, Vancouver, and Victoria, I think. So they only measure what people in those cities are watching. So they don't measure the north, where we are going to have a huge audience. They don't measure rural communities. They don't measure reserves. They don't measure the entire province of Saskatchewan or Manitoba, where there's high Aboriginal populations. So based on the numbers that we see, we're like, okay, well, this is how many we think non-Native people are watching us in urban centers. And so those numbers look pretty good. So just imagine how many people are actually watching us. You know, like if we could measure the north, if we could measure our communities.
It must be difficult because you've got this sort of dual purpose of representing Aboriginal issues and Aboriginal stories to the rest of society, but also serving those communities themselves.
Like we tend to see a surge, particularly when there's something going on and people want to know something about it.
Yeah.
So they'll hear something maybe in the mainstream media and they'll go, there's not much there. And then they'll Google and they'll land on APTN and they'll find a ton of information. But people do want to know, like, what's going on. I don't think there's a divide on news where just because you're not Aboriginal, you don't care what's happening in Aboriginal communities.
Especially as some of these issues seem to be the most vital issues. I mean, whether it's something that grabs everybody's attention, like missing and murdered, or if it's a pipeline story, these are some of the biggest questions in Canada right now. And when you've got major news organizations fleeing the regions and not able to have feet on the ground, especially in the north, I wonder if you guys have like a unique position to kind of feed into a larger news cycle if you can be the first responder.
Yeah, and it happens. We just had a story about an Aboriginal soldier who faced discrimination and was assaulted, and that got picked up by mainstream news. The work that we've done on residential schools where some of the lawyers were, I guess, basically cheating the residential school survivors out of some of their money. That got picked up by mainstream news. A lot of the missing and murdered women, we report it first. It gets picked up by mainstream news. There's a bunch of examples of where we report something first and it gets picked up and it gets disseminated, yeah.
Tell me about the push into the States.
I honestly can't tell you much. I wouldn't want to misspeak and make something up. They're looking at the opportunity at this point. What I will say, and we were talking about this earlier, about the the excitement. Like, imagine when there was no APTN.
Tell me again when you started.
APTN started in 1999, and the news started in 2000.
In 2000. So you've been around long enough that you might be seeing journalists enter the field who grew up watching guys cover the news. Yeah. I wonder about that, you know, especially when you've got such remote communities, but people do have smartphones and, you know, as hacking it as the term has become, citizen journalists, there are situations where you're not going to be able to have a crew there, but somebody could document it. Is there any kind of a kind of ad hoc network?
Well, we've tried to scoop that up, because I think, like, as a journalist, you always, like, you've got the rules that you kind of need to play by, right? Like, you can't do a story if you're too close to it. You have to make sure that it's balanced, that you've got both sides. And so it takes a certain amount of training. On the other hand, Journalists for Human Rights, and I think a lot of people are familiar with their work in Africa in training journalists. Well, they've been working up in Northern Ontario, training Aboriginal youth. And so we set up a partnership with them that they would go out and do some initial training, and then they would find some kind of star candidates and they'd send them over here and we would take them on as interns. So we've just started that. We haven't actually had anybody come from that particular community, but they have found other young people.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, they're dynamite.
Yeah.
We've got one, Jaden, and you can see her on national news if you watch. We've given her a short-term contract.
Okay, what's your last name? We'll give her the full plug.
Jaden Flett.
Okay.
And, she came on as an intern after a few months with us. We had somebody on maternity, so now she's on contract. Another one, Brandy Morin. You'll see her occasionally on television, but she's doing more of the net for us right now.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to beef up for our anticipated federal election coverage. And so we wanted to add somebody at least short term to the net. So she came on as an intern and she was fantastic. So we gave her a contract as a web writer, but she's still doing some broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
We created a whole industry in Canada of Aboriginal producers, writers, filmmakers.
Is your whole news staff Aboriginal?
Not the whole new staff. No, there's probably about 75-76%
mm-hmm.
Aboriginal. So Métis, Inuit, First Nations. And the rest are others. they're not all Caucasian.
Miscellaneous.
Miscellaneous, yeah.
You know, we're sitting here in Winnipeg, a city that recently was called the most racist in Canada by Maclean's.
Yeah.
How does that influence what you do being here in this city? And, like, what did you think of that story and the city's reaction to it?
It's interesting, you know, because I moved out here. I lived in Ottawa up until I took this job in 2012. And there is a native population in Ottawa, but Ottawa is a very different kind of city. It's probably the one city where if you're native or if you're female, you can earn the same or earn more than, other Canadians, right? Like, those stats anywhere else are kind of off. And it's a very different feel from Winnipeg.
Why is that?
Well, I think it's because it's government.
Yeah.
And the government, like, I mean, whatever you think about the government, when you walk into a government office, they really have tried to diversify their offices. Like, there was recently a study or a report that came out where they were kind of looking at the history of how they managed to get so many women so quickly up into management levels and how that compares with the private industry. And they're way ahead of the game.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that really strikes you when you come out here to Winnipeg is that you just look out and you see Aboriginal people everywhere. Like I said, there is an Aboriginal population in Ottawa, but here you just, it's larger, and I think it's just somehow more apparent. Maybe you don't notice who people are so much when you're all dressed the same and wearing suits and those little cards like we all walk around with in Ottawa, right? So it's more diverse. I have not had anything personally happen to me that since I've been in Winnipeg that I would say is different than maybe racism that I've encountered in other cities. And because people can't see me, I should maybe just say that I'm a lightly olive-skinned woman with blue eyes and brownish, kind of reddish hair. So it's not always apparent to people when they see me that I'm Aboriginal right away.
Yeah.
So I've kind of spent my life overhearing things. You know, like people don't realize who you are when you're in the room.
Because you pass, you get to hear what people actually say.
And I'm not trying, you understand, I'm not trying to pass, but people just assume that there are no Aboriginal people in the room and they're safe to say whatever. And I mean, I remember in school having one teacher, he was teaching religion class. I went to a Catholic school. And I remember him talking about poverty in Canada. And he was talking about all like poverty and how horrible it was. And at one point he goes, well, there's one other group in Canada that's poor, you know, natives because they're lazy. Huh? And then he skipped over it. And I was just like, did I really just hear that?
Yeah.
Did he just say that? And in all places in religion class? I had an economics teacher that got up and was talking about what had recently been in the news. And she was mentioning, oh, yeah, First Nations, they want their self-government, but they still want their welfare checks. Have I noticed that things are different here? No. But I think maybe sometimes in cities like Ottawa, people just – they hide them a little better. I think that there is – racism across Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of don't want to give Canada a bad rap either because, I mean, we see it a lot in the stories we cover at the grassroots level, like when you mentioned the pipeline. We see a lot of non-Native communities, or not Native people, joining in with our communities to share on that. We see a lot of non-Native people showing up at missing and murdered Aboriginal women rallies as well. So, yes, racism exists in Canada, but fortunately, I think it's getting better.
I think one interesting conversation that broke out of that story was a knee-jerk reaction from a lot of people who live here who interpreted that as an attack on them, saying that they are terribly racist. And as defined by whether you say these racist things or not, well, no, I don't. Or sure, I've heard people say it, but not more so than in other cities. And the counter-argument to that was, no. Institutionally, this is a city where if you are Aboriginal – you are going to live very differently statistically than other people. And, you know, my on one side of my family, my roots are from the North End here, and that is a neighborhood now that would surprise a lot of people in Canada. And whether you look at that as a race problem or a poverty problem, or you can see that they're both, you know, I guess depends on how you define racism.
You know, we were comparing Ottawa and Winnipeg. The three places I've lived in my life are Ottawa, Toronto, and Winnipeg, right? So those are the three cities that I kind of know best. In Ottawa, it's a wealthy population.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see the problems. Winnipeg, just overall, I think has a wealthy population, but it has a lot more poverty. So I think you hit something there. But why are First Nations people so darn poor? becomes a question. And there you start to hit on the question of a systematic racism.
Yeah,
you know, you sit there and you go, why would it be acceptable anywhere else for a community not to have a school, for kids to have to leave the community at the tender age of 12 and basically go into care or go live with someone else so that they can pursue, even a junior high education? How can you expect kids to be successful? That's just one example, but it's the whole issue of it wouldn't be acceptable anywhere else, so why is it acceptable in First Nations communities?
The question of acceptability is one that I think whenever it does, on rare occasion, enter a public discourse, there's the response is always just to turn it right back on the Aboriginal community. So whenever –
we talked about that earlier, right?
Whenever missing and murdered – well, that's because of our Aboriginal men. And whenever – is Winnipeg a racist city? Well, if it's an economic issue, well, let's make that about internal problems or corruption problems. It always seems like that's – I wonder if you see it as the role to kind of force people to, you know, to talk about this stuff or think about it differently, or at least to kind of make that opportunity to engage with it, you know, a possibility.
If you have time, and I think mainstream doesn't take the time, and this is what we take the time to do, is to break it down and go, well, let's take a look. How much money is that? How much money is that per community? What did the parliamentary budget officers say about the state of infrastructure on schools? None of them have libraries. None of them have computers. Those things would cost this much. And it's like, well, you do the math. There really is a problem here.
Yeah. And I guess as opposed to sort of a deliberate advocacy activist role, simply telling these stories and making the information available and catalog, I mean, just doing journalism itself.
Well, that's it. I think, people can't pay attention if you don't tell the story. Yeah. So the first job is to tell the story. And I think that was the big gap. I remember, RCAP is so long ago, but out of RCAP, the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People, 1996, one of the things they said is that Aboriginal people need their own media. They're portrayed as angry warriors or passive victims. We're not passive victims. We have agency. You know, we're real people that things happen to. We're struggling. We're doing things. And we're not just angry warriors. But those were the only times that we were ever in the news. And there still is that tendency in news today. I think we are having an influence on it. I do see that other media is paying attention to what APTN does. And you are getting sort of a more fulsome picture of who we are. But they still have a long way to go. I mean, we're lucky. We get to do nothing else all day. So, of course, we're going to be better at it.
Yeah. Why do you think we need APTN?
I wouldn't want to imagine a world without APTN in it. And I don't say that just because I work here. I think that it's become part of like a staple in the diversity of Canada, in giving people a voice who didn't have a voice before, and in being able to start a conversation between Native and non-Native people in Canada. And I can't imagine, like, what would it be like if that suddenly went quiet?
That's your Canada Land Show. I hope you enjoyed it. You can email me at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read them all. I respond when I can. I'm on Twitter at Jesse Brown, and the show's website is canadalandshow.com. I make this show with Katie Jensen. The next episode of Canada Land Commons will be up tomorrow on Tuesday, and the next episode of Shortcuts will be online Thursday. If you like this show, support it.
Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures. And it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.